please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Ian Kay.
My name is Ian. I'm an alcoholic. It's good to be here. It's an honor to be able to speak at an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. I've spoken here before, and I felt the same thing like I was in jail. Being interrogated or something. You know, before I speak, I get nervous, and I always got to use the restroom real quick. And the problem with that is I get terrified that my fly is going to be down when I get up to speak. So then when I get up here, I'm like terrified that my fly is down. And I actually, it was maybe a month or two ago when I was in New York speaking on a sponsorship panel, and I was up there, and the guy in the front, he's like trying to motion to me, and I get all distracted. I said, "What?" And he mouthed something. I couldn't hear him, and he mouthed it again. I couldn't hear him. I said, "I can't hear you." He says, "Your fly's down." You know, and he said it just enough that every single person in the room heard. And it wasn't that bad. So, you know, if that was my biggest fear, I guess I've come a long way in Alcoholics Anonymous. But, my sobriety date's March 7th, 2005. Ideally, that'll be the last day I will have to be separated from alcohol. Part of that, I believe, is under my power. Part of that, I realize, is completely not under my power. There is some things that I have to do and I have to participate in. One of my favorite sayings in Alcoholics Anonymous is that God will move mountains, but I got to bring the shovel, and I believe that's exactly how Alcoholics Anonymous works. You know, God will absolutely work in my life. God will move mountains in my life. But if I'm too busy and I can't get off the couch because I'm too busy, like watching Friends or the Phillies or something, God's probably not going to move flyers, whatever. I asked Chase if the Bruins were playing the Phillies tonight, so that's how much I know about sports. But I'm convinced that, like, if I don't put in the footwork, nothing's going to happen. Absolutely nothing's going to happen. I guess I want to get out some of my thoughts here because I'm going to think about it the whole night. I currently don't have a home group. I'm in transition. I technically don't really even have a place to live tonight. I do. I have a place to sleep. I'm paying rent in an apartment in the Dominican Republic, and I'll be down there on Friday. I've just left Vermont, or actually I just left New Hampshire. You know, God's moved me into some places and is making some things happen in my life. Some more dreams are coming true in my life. And I say more dreams because my original dreams came true in Alcoholics Anonymous, and once they came true, I realized those dreams weren't big enough, so I needed to have bigger dreams. And then I had bigger dreams, and now those are coming true. And that's kind of what the last 7 years of my life have been about. The reason this Dominican Republic thing is on my mind is I've asked some of the home group members if they would be willing to Skype in this meeting for myself and a couple other people down there, and ideally have a nice little computer right up there that's very discreet, so we can be a part of a meeting that's carrying a message of hope. When I was down there, there's basically in the part of the island I'm going to live, it's primarily Spanish-speaking, and I know maybe like 5 Spanish words. I would assume I will learn. But I guess I'm going to have to learn. But the other folks that are down there, there's a couple folks who do worked a similar program in Alcoholics Anonymous as I do. I was at a couple meetings that I visited down there, and one was like a typical AA meeting. And the other meeting was very interesting. They read out of, what's that book called? As Bill Sees It. Something about resentments out of the big book, something off page 64, I believe. And the first woman who shared, she was real wound up. And she shared about how, unfortunately, the night before her guest house was burned down. Somebody burned it down on her. And she shared about how it was robbed about a week before that. And because there's no real police system, it's a third world country, they couldn't do anything. And then the guy came back the next week later and burned it down. So that she shared about how she was angry and she wanted to kill him. And I thought to myself, yeah, that sounds legitimate. I would probably be that angry too. And then the next guy who shared was like, yeah, you probably should kill him. And then the third guy who shared was like, absolutely, I agree with everyone. And no joke. Now, mind you, there's only like on a big, like we're talking big AA day down there. It's like 15 people. Big day. There's 7 meetings a week. 4 of them are discussion meetings. What they need to discuss week after week, I don't really understand. Especially if they all know each other. I mean, it's only 15 people. You can only discuss stuff so many times in a row. I mean, how many gratitude meetings can you have? So then, you know, it's going around and it's going around, and pretty much everyone's echoing this idea of like, yeah, we should have this guy killed. And I'm starting to scratch my head and thinking they can't be serious, right? Like, they've got to be just joking. And I look out of the cabana where the meetings are, and I look over at my friend, and she's sitting there smoking a butt, and she kind of does this like, eh. You know, like, yeah, that's kind of what happens down here. And now I'm real confused, you know, like I was under the impression that A is a spiritual program of action, not a spiritual program of let's murder people who burn houses down. And by the time it gets to the old timer who says, you know, I've been on this island for 20 years and I haven't had to take a drink. And then he gets into, well, I know people and we can make this happen. And I'm thinking, you got to be kidding me. I'm trying to move down here and this is what I get to look forward to. So to be honest, like in all joking aside, like, you know, it talks about on page 84 in the book, it talks about sanity will have returned. At the end of More About Alcoholism, it says something along the lines of that there's really only one thing that's going to keep us away from a drink, and that's our connection with God. See, the most sane thought I've had probably in 7 years is knowing that if I go down there and I do not try to participate in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm getting drunk. Like, my experience overwhelmingly has shown me that, like, when I don't participate in a spiritual program of recovery, I get drunk. That's my experience. My experience is almost exactly the same as the chapter More About Alcoholism. In that chapter, it talks about 4 people. One guy gets drunk with a resentment over and over and over again. The other guy just can't stop drinking, the jaywalker. But then there are these other 2 guys. And these 2 guys, you know, one of them is very successful, stays sober for 25 years, retires, drinks and dies. The other guy drinks when there's not a cloud on the horizon. So basically what it's showing me is that 2 out of 4 people will drink when life is good. The reason this thought about, like, I need to figure out what else I can do for AA besides participate in those meetings is because I'm going to live in a magical tropical island. All of my dreams have come true. Like life couldn't be better for me. And for anyone who's been in AA more than like 2 or 3 years, you'll understand what I'm talking about. But like, as my life gets good, there's this like little voice that says, well, I mean, it's almost 8 o'clock. Do you really need to go to that meeting tonight? You know, like I don't fear a drink. Like, I don't believe that my disease is hiding behind a car out there doing push-ups, like waiting for me, like lurking in the shadows. That's not my experience today. You know, my experience today is that because of Alcoholics Anonymous and because of practicing these principles and because of going to meetings and because of working with newcomers and doing all that at a day at a time, like, my experience is, like, I'm not afraid of alcohol. My experience also tells me that that can be a problem in itself. Right? Like, it talks about we're neither cocky nor are we afraid. You know, and sometimes I do get a little cocky. So what I've been trying to do is really kind of bring AA around me, you know, where that 12th step is really where I'm the receiver of the 12th step more than I am the responder of the 12th step, because that's how I was kind of taught, that sometimes I need to be the giver and sometimes I need to be the taker. My first step started with somebody's 12th step, and that's how I understand AA to be. You know, it becomes this cycle of the new guy in the room doesn't know that he's got a problem, and then this other guy who's doing a 12 step goes and shares that message, and it becomes this cycle, right, of one alcoholic sharing with another. So when it comes brought up at the group and the group members are here now, you know my spiel, and I would kindly ask that you consider putting this computer in the room and helping some people out in a third world country. So anyway, all right, now that that's over with. I was raised up in Pennsylvania, up in New Tripoli. I started my my career of drinking probably in like Allentown area. My uncle, who I'm just realizing, that side of my family, there's a lot of drunks on that side of the family, and I've just put this together recently. I didn't know this before, but I was at a party with them the other night, and they all drink a lot. Like, they drink a lot, and I didn't realize that. I don't think I realized that. There should have been a red flag. My first drink was when I was about 5. I would get the beer from my dad from the fridge, and I would take a sip, and then I would hand him the beer when he would come home. When I was around 10-ish, my family at my uncle's house, he still has a beautiful wooden bar in the basement, fully stocked. I mean, this thing is nice. This is an alcoholic dream come true. Fully stocked, and they taught me how to be the bartender. On that side of the family, I am not anymore the youngest, but I was the youngest for a long time. So, I mean, you have a group full of adults, and you got one 10-year-old who's got the look at me syndrome, you know. So what do? They plop me behind the bar. They teach me how to make drinks. The rule was, if Chase ordered a Southern Comfort, I could make it, and then I could have a sip. I could just taste it. If he ordered 2 Southern Comforts, I wasn't allowed to taste the second because I already knew what it tasted like. So what would happen is, Chase would order a Southern Comfort, I would taste it, and then he would come back for the second one, and I would say, well, don't you want to try something else? Now, mind you, I was 10. I was like 10 years old, 10, 12 years old. Like, I was a little kid. Like, I didn't know what was happening. I didn't know that there was something going on in my body that was beyond my control. Right? I didn't realize that. I just knew that I wanted another taste. That progressed. 14, I started to get expelled. It became a downward spiral. I was seeing drug and alcohol counselors forever. And I don't know if they knew what they were talking about, but I sure didn't think they knew what they were talking about. One of them, I went to VOTEC, the Lehigh County VOTEC. I got kicked out of there. I got kicked out everywhere. I went to Valley Forge Military Academy. I got kicked out of there. So I kicked out of one place after another. And the reason being is because, A, I thought I could do whatever I wanted. I didn't think the rules applied to me. And I thought it was perfectly fine to drink alcohol before school. I learned very quickly that algebra, after like a little bit of vodka, was way better than algebra sober. Now, mind you, I wasn't drinking in the morning because I had to drink in the morning. I was drinking in the morning because I wanted to drink in the morning. So whatever, I got kicked out of all these schools. Drug and alcohol counselor says, maybe you should go to college. I said, you're crazy. I'm done with school. Get me out of here. He says, listen. He says, you like to snowboard, right? I said, yes. I lived basically at Blue Mountain and Bear Creek. It was Doe Mountain back then, but I lived there in the winters. He says, well, maybe if you go to college somewhere, you can like go to parties and meet some girls and snowboard somewhere. And I said, so how do I get to college? What do I got to do? You know, like, give me a form to fill out. Like, let's get going here. Why didn't someone tell me this before? So I found a school in Burlington, Vermont. I moved to Burlington, Vermont. On the way, you go up 87 and you go from Plattsburgh. You take the ferry over into Burlington. And on the way across the ferry, my father gives me this prayer when I was 18. And he says something along the lines of, Ian, your whole life can be different. Your whole life can change. No one knows you're up here. Because what I will say, and some of you guys probably had the same thing happen, like I got the reputation, so then even if I didn't do it, it was my fault. And there was a lot of like that was like legitimately happening. I mean, I was definitely the maker of a lot of my problems. But I did get kind of caught in this cycle up at Northwestern Lehigh. And he says to me, he says, no one knows you. Your whole life can be different, right? This is the time. You can change everything. He gives me some prayer. I have no idea what the prayer said. Stuff that in my wallet. Get off the ferry. I get to school. I couldn't chase them out fast enough. I quickly became an entrepreneur. I changed my classes to Tuesdays and Thursdays. I partied 5 of those days. I never skipped a day of college class, not once. because I would go to school drunk. No one kicked me out. No one cared. Some people might laugh at me, but no one cared. I used to wear this glass pipe that looked like a necklace around my neck. And I know this is AA, and I'm a very strong proponent of the singleness of purpose, but I wore this little pipe that was packed around my neck, and I would, like, excuse myself from class, and I would go out, and I would take a hit or two, and then I would have a little sip of something, and then I would go back into class, and I didn't think there was a problem. Now, on top of all this, I was trying to get a degree in social work. And at one point, I swear to God, at one point I was dead set in being a drug and alcohol counselor. I was really not well. I was dead set on being a drug and alcohol counselor, so I was like trying to do these like extra trainings. I was on the drug and alcohol advisory committee for Champlain College. Meanwhile, I was like doing this other stuff over here, being all shady, like being an entrepreneur, drinking at night. And like my theory was like I knew what these kids were going through. Like that's why I was going to be good at helping them, because I knew firsthand. However, I didn't think I had a problem. Now, mind you, up to that point, I think I'd been arrested 6 or 7 times by that point, all drinking and drug-related. My first DUI was down in Philadelphia. I was 20 years old. I drove up a one-way street onto a sidewalk into a wall. My second DUI was in Vermont. I was driving up and down off the sidewalk, not like fully on the sidewalk, but like my wheels would go up and then come down, and then go up and then come down. Like, this is the way I drink alcohol. I'm not like the casual, like, let's sip a little cocktail. I'm like, ooh, I think I've had too much. Like, I drink alcohol, and I drink a lot of it, and I drink it till it's gone, or I drink until I fall asleep or pass out. I like to call it falling asleep. Most people would call it passing out. And that's what happens. So here I am. I'm in Burlington, Vermont, and I'm teaching preschool, believe it or not. Actually, let's be honest. I was an assistant preschool teacher. Teaching preschool sounds better, but I was an assistant preschool teacher. My hair was, like, down to here. I was about 60 pounds less than I weigh now. No, 40 pounds. I'm sorry, 40 pounds less than I weigh now. I was 160 pounds. My eyes were black. My skin was green. And I was like a mess. I was a complete mess. I was a complete mess. I would take a rainbow of pills throughout the day. I thought I had an anxiety problem. Some of you will relate to this. At night when I would sleep, I would sweat profusely. And I would have to change 2 and 3 shirts at night. I would wake up real jittery and shaky. And I thought it was an anxiety problem. I didn't realize that I was actually detoxing from alcohol. I would wake up in the morning and I would take these pills which would get rid of the shakes, but I really liked them, so I would take a couple extra, but then I would get sleepy, and I, you know, being sleepy at a preschool doesn't work, so then I would take these other pills that would wake me up. But I usually took too many of them too, so then I would have to take some more of the white pills to calm me back down a little bit. And then 3 o'clock would roll around and I would go to the liquor store, and whatever money I had, I would put it on the table and I would get my booze. And it was like I couldn't drink fast enough. You know, like when I came into AA, I thought I was a drug addict. I really did. I came in as an addict, and then I started to say I'm an addict alcoholic. And then I started to say I'm an alcoholic addict, and then I started to, like, clear up a little bit, and I realized that I'm an alcoholic. I like drugs. I really did. I liked all of them. My favorite ones were yours. but I wasn't picky. You know, and the one thing that, like, man, like, I remember that so vividly. Like, I would be doing the drugs all day long, and, like, once I got that booze on my hand, I mean, I feel it now, like, that, that sense of relief, like, it washed over me. You know, I could just crack that can or twist the top, and I would put it to my lips, and, but then I would get thirsty. And then I would drink a little more, and I would get even thirstier. It was like I would have this unquenchable thirst inside, and I just couldn't drink fast enough. I remember by the time I got sober, I was drinking cans of beer in 3 sips. 1, 2, 3, crack. 1, 2, 3, crack. It was like a dance, you know, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3 all the time. I just couldn't drink fast enough. There was this kid. My friend Derek, I know Derek has spoken here a couple times, very flamboyant, long hair, hopefully he listens to the recording. He was very annoying. Still can be. Derek was the only other guy working at the preschool. And he would read this book, the Gray Daily Reflections book. And he wasn't like, you know, hiding in the corner, like protecting his anonymity, like secretly reading this book. He would just like, you know, pick it up and read it and then set it down. And I was like, what are you reading over there? And he let me read it. And I tried like spiritual stuff. I went to India and I studied Buddhism. I prayed to Haile Selassie with my dreadlocks at one point. I would skateboard around Burlington following bands, barefoot, wearing sarongs. I meditated with crystals. I tried this, like, spiritual stuff, but I couldn't. Do I say like a lot? Uh-huh. Do I? My father's been on me about that. Let me know if I say like a lot. So I was trying this, like, see, I do. I hate when he's right. So I was trying all this spiritual stuff, but I wasn't trying to get well. Right, I was following these moral and philosophical convictions, and I had them galore, like the book says. And none of it seemed to work. I couldn't quote get my together. You know, if I had a dollar for every time my mom asked me when are you going to get your together, I'd be rich. I could retire probably. But I wanted to. I really did want to. But for some reason, I wasn't able to do it. I wasn't able to get there. It was like I could see the light at the end of the tunnel, but I couldn't get to it. It was always at the end of the tunnel. And it never seemed that the light was ever getting closer. So he's reading this Daily Reflections book, and it was around February, and it was all about, like, you know, if you've read the Daily Reflections book, February, step two stuff. And I was into it. I was really into it. And he says, you know, why don't you come to an AA meeting? I said, well, I'm not an alcoholic. Why would I do that? And we kind of talked a little bit. And I don't really know what was said. But I was pretty much like, well, I'm not an alcoholic. I don't need to go. There was a snowboard competition that weekend. I was one of the judges. I judged the competition. My parents came up. It was my birthday, my 23rd birthday. I didn't drink. They left, and then it was a Sunday, and I went over to a friend's, and I told him how I quit drinking. And we were going to go out to get dinner. It was a cold March. It was March 6th, I guess, or maybe it was March 6th. We were going to go out and get something to eat for dinner. And we didn't go to this one restaurant because they serve booze. And we didn't go to another restaurant because they serve booze. And I wasn't drinking anymore, and he was cool with that. But nothing really was open, so we went to Coyote's Cafe. And Coyote's Cafe served these really good margaritas they made with Patron tequila. And I really like Patron tequila. I still like Patron tequila. I mean, let's face it. I just haven't drank it in a while. And I remember walking through the door saying I wasn't going to drink. That I quit. And he said, are you sure? And I said, I'm fine. And I remember sitting down at the table, and we were still talking about how I wasn't going to drink. And the next thing I remember is there was an empty pitcher of margaritas in front of me with one straw, and I was ordering my second, and he was looking at me like I had three eyes. And I mean, I ordered the drink, and I kind of had that like, huh. And I drank the second one. And it was no big deal. And I went home and I wasn't drunk. And that kind of bothered me. Because it was also to the point where, like, some nights I would drink two beers and blackout, and then the other nights I would just drink and drink and drink and not even feel buzzed. And I went to work the next day, and Derek says, so, how'd it go? And I was like, oh, you know. And he's like, oh, you drank, didn't you? I told you you'd drink. And I was like, you know, whatever. He's like, why don't you come to a meeting? And I said, okay, would you please pick me up? He says, I'll pick you up. He calls me maybe 20 minutes before the meeting. He says, hey, I can't pick you up. I got to pick up these girls. I said, thanks. He said, but you can walk there. Thanks. So I got my skateboard and I walked up, and it was maybe two or three blocks. And man, if this is your first meeting or your first week in AA, or you're coming back, and this is one of those things that are super scary. I remember that walk. I remember that walk in Vermont in March, and it was freezing cold, and it was wet, and it was dark, and I had no idea what I was getting involved into. And I had no idea where I was going. I knew it was in some building at UVM, and I had no idea what I was going to expect. And I walked in, and it was behind, you like walk behind this fireplace into a conference room back there, and there was a bunch of people in there who were remotely my age, and that's when I did my first, like, what is this? And they started to go around, and they were reading the third step out of the big book, and I had a piece of aquamarine, so I still had real long hair then, and you like that? And I still had real long hair, and I had this piece of aquamarine because it was the stone of courage, and I was terrified, but like they started to share, and they started to share about their relationship with a God of their own understanding. And I put my hand up real quick, and I shared because I wanted them to know my profound knowledge around God and spiritual matters, because I've been to India, and like I said, I studied this stuff. And they looked at me, and they said, yeah, keep coming back. Good for you. Keep coming back. And I thought that was just the greatest thing in the world. My friends have been telling me to get lost for a while. In fact, the last night that I got drunk, I was putting my shoes on down in like the mud room, and I could hear my, quote, friends in the other room talking about me, and they're like, that kid, he sucks, get him out of here, I don't want to be with him anymore, he needs to leave. You know, like that, and those were my like, quote, best friends. Because I couldn't, like, and that night that I drank, like, I went to the store, and I put nickels, pennies, and dimes on the counter to get 2 40s, because that's all I could afford. Now I was working full time. And that's all I could afford, was 2 40s with dimes, nickels, and pennies. You know, my diet consisted of American cheese with barbecue sauce and white bread. If I, like, really wanted to splurge, I would buy hot dogs. I really lived an absolutely miserable existence. And that stuff, what happened was, so I did, that night, I'm a first night. And that night what happened is they said, get a sponsor. They said, here's some books, read these. And that night I asked Derek to sponsor me. I think it was like the next night he said, you know, if you don't want me to be your sponsor, you can find someone else. I immediately got a different sponsor. And I asked this guy, I said, what do I do? Like, let's do something. See, I had this intellectual knowledge. I was going to these like substance abuse trainings. I was like trying to get the intellectual knowledge to help people. I went to school. I had the degree, but I didn't think I had a problem. I mean, my criminal record is crystal clear that I've got some sort of a problem, at least with the police, that's for sure. But I didn't know what was wrong with me. And I came into AA, and they basically said, here's the solution, let's rock and roll. And I said, okay, let's do it. And I started off on this path. And my sponsor, we did steps 1, 2, and 3, and we kind of stopped, and it was April then. And I said, you know, what about all these other steps? It's a 12-step program. I was under the false delusion that everyone in AA worked the steps. I figured it made sense. It's a 12-step program. Why wouldn't you work the steps? I have come to believe, or well now know, that is the most insane thing you can do in Alcoholics Anonymous, which is come to a 12-step program and not work the steps. If you're doing that, I would encourage you to work the steps. So I asked this guy to whatever, take me through, and we start doing some step work. And I had this like weird love-hate relationship with Alcoholics Anonymous. The love part was that you understood me and you wouldn't kick me out. The hate part was you people were crazy, and you were a bunch of dorks, all right? But I was also that, like, newcomer that, like, there was bets going around about when I was going to drink again, right? I would walk into the meetings. I basically got this one company. It's called Tech9, a snowboard company. I got a lot of their stuff very, 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 very cheap. They like to give it to me for almost cost. So I would wear these matching Tech9 jumpsuits. That's definitely worth laughing about. I would wear these matching Tech9 jumpsuits, and I would come into meetings with my hood like up over my head and a bandana on. And I would come in with my skateboard, and I wouldn't like quietly set it in the corner. I would toss it in the corner because I wanted you to know I was here. And then I would slap people's hands, you know, like it'd be nice and quiet like this, and I would like, you know, come up through the thing and slap people's hands. Because, like, I hated you guys, but I wanted you to look at me. Like, I wanted you to notice that I was here and doing well. Because I wasn't doing well for a long time. Eventually, I moved back down to Pennsylvania. I lived with my parents for 3 months. Because I was the whole first 2 months of my sobriety, I was living in an active house. So those of you who need some special place to go to get sober, get some willingness, and you might be able to do it where you are. My willingness came from basically in the living room there was people doing cocaine, getting shit-faced, and I was in my bedroom writing a four-step. I literally, like, no joke, I would go to 5 meetings on Saturday. I would go to the 8 o'clock meeting. I would go to the 10 o'clock meeting. I would go to the 12 o'clock meeting. I would go to the 5:30 at night meeting, and then I would go to the 8 o'clock meeting, and then sometimes I'd go to the 10 o'clock at night meeting. On a normal work day, after working an 8-hour day, I would run off to the 5:30 meeting. Then I would go to an 8 o'clock meeting. Then I would go to the 10 o'clock meeting. Why? Because at home was a bunch of people blowing lines of cocaine and getting drunk. Like I had nowhere to go. I had nothing to do. I didn't know about sober houses and treatment. I don't know. I did have a degree in social work. I had no idea about treatment centers. I didn't even know there was such a thing called rehab. My mom told me at one point that she did put me in a rehab, and apparently I signed myself out. I don't remember a lick of it. I thought it was a psych ward. And I do remember threatening my uncle on the phone in a padded room, but that's all I remember. Like, what I knew when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous was, like, there is this program of recovery, right? It's not necessarily going to a lot of meetings, but it is this 12-step work, right? It is this stuff that's got to be done, and I was like, let's do it. Like, what do I got to do? Because I don't want to feel the way I feel. I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired. I'm sick and tired of waking up every single morning feeling like I want to die. Like, I'm over it. I'm absolutely over it. And you're telling me that this is going to work, so what? Like, where else do I got to go? You know, like, the chronic relapsers that can, like, come in and then go hang out in, like, the fun world for a little while and then come back and dry off and then go back out in the fun world. Like, I don't get that. I don't understand that. Like, my life was so terrible when I got sober. There was no, like, like, there was no game to play anymore. There was no game. You know, they talk about how AA was like the last house on the block with the last light on. Like, I crawled for that house. I wanted to be there so bad. And I came into Alcoholics Anonymous and I started to do the work. And eventually, like, that wasn't good enough. And I needed to find someone else to have a deeper experience. And eventually that wasn't good enough. And then I needed to find somebody else to have a deeper experience. Right? And I've consistently, like, the one thing, and thank you, Lord, for keeping this in my heart, is the one thing that I've stayed close to in Alcoholics Anonymous is the fact that I am absolutely, absolutely without a shadow of a doubt powerless over alcohol. And I'm absolutely crystal clear that without Alcoholics Anonymous, I am going to drink again and I am going to die. I know that without a shadow of a doubt. My whole life, I did go on to get a master's degree, and I am a counselor, and I do have my own business, and I work with families now whose kids are a pain in the rear end. And I got licensed, and I got, like, all this fancy knowledge. Like, I got the book smarts, right? I'm about to become certified as an addiction specialist, whatever the hell that means. But, like, the truth is, like, that's not going to keep me sober. Like, I can quote you the big book. Like, I have the opportunity, the great opportunity to be able to go places and do big book workshops. But that's not going to keep me sober. You know, like, I could sit here and I can quote page numbers and I can quote paragraphs and I can break it down and I can tell you what it means, but none of that is going to keep me sober. Right? Like, what's going to keep me sober is my relationship with God. What's going to keep me sober is whether I continuously revisit inventory, whether I continuously surrender my will and my life over to God, whether I continuously believe that God is actually going to restore me to sanity. That there is this power that's greater than me. There is this power that can move me and push me into places that I've never dreamed of. That's the stuff that's going to keep me sober. You know, my experience is that I've had these bouts, terrible bouts, of untreated alcoholism, thinking I was well in Alcoholics Anonymous, right? Eric always jokes around with me. When I met Eric, I think I had 80 pairs of Nikes. And I always joke around with my buddies from Boston. It's like, you know a new guy in Boston because he's got a fresh fade and he's got a fly pair of white Nikes on. Like, you know. The girl, you know the girl's new because she's got a brand new hairdo, glossy nails, and a new purse. You know, like, I was doing that with, like, numerous years of Alcoholics Anonymous, like buying more sneakers. I'm covered in tattoos. I mean, I've got $5,000 worth of tattoos all over my body. Thank God you'd never know it today. But all of that is because, like, in sobriety, it got to a place where, like, I wasn't comfortable anymore and I needed ease and comfort. You know, it talks about it in the doctor's opinion. It says, I'm restless, irritable, and discontent, and the less I can experience the sense of ease and comfort that comes at once by taking a few drinks. Right? I'm working at the preschool. I get out of the preschool, and all I want is that drink, right? That. Ease and comfort. Like, that's not a bad thing. That's like the best thing. And what happened to me in a period of sobriety, or after a period of sobriety, where I start to get lazy with this stuff, I start to think, if I could only have 6.4% body fat and be able to deadlift 365. Well, I'm telling you, I was at 6.4% body fat deadlifting 365, working out twice a day on some neurotic diet, and I was still miserable. Well, maybe if I just got that pair of Air Force Ones, I would be okay. And then I got that pair of Air Force Ones. And then I thought, well, maybe they're coming out with this new colorway next week. Maybe if I got them too in those Jordans, those new Jordan 5 retros that are coming out. And then I got those, and I still was empty on the inside. You know, it's been this, like, and my whole sobriety has been this battle of, like, revisiting this around these, like, other things, you know, this, like, discontent. And I've watched people terribly suffer with food and pornography and shopping and relationship issues over and over and over, because when they're sober, that becomes a problem and they want ease and comfort. And the delusion is, I tend to think that thing's going to give me ease and comfort. That's the biggest lie I've ever told myself, is that thing over there is going to help me. Because it does, for just a quick second. But then when that thing starts, that phenomenon of craving develops, and then I pass through the well-known stages of spree, and I just can't stop. And then I'm screwed all over again. I want to talk about, I think, a couple steps that I think are really, really important to me. Specifically are steps 6 and 7. And where I don't know what it's like down here, but where I got sober, you know, a lot of people often said things like, well, 6 and 7, they're just 2 paragraphs in the big book. It's not that big of a deal. You know, just do it real quick and move on. And we used it out of the 12 and 12 because really they didn't put enough in the big book, so you got to go to the 12 and 12. And I got thinking about that for a while, and I got thinking about, I have a problem with driving. I speed. I like to go fast. I don't know if anyone relates to that. So I started to get speeding tickets. I was commuting from Vermont to New Hampshire every week. It was a 3-hour drive on these back roads in Vermont, you know, through like Killington, these stupid roads where the speed limit's 45 and then all of a sudden drops to 25 and... You know, there's a cop waiting. He's like, ah, sucker, you know. Here's a speeding ticket. Thank you. You just paid my salary. So I start getting these speeding tickets, and I would tell my friends, like, yeah, whatever. Like, whatever. I'll do the crime, do the time. Like, sure, I'll take a speeding ticket. No big deal. Like, I don't really think I should have to. I think these speed limits are suggestions anyway. I don't really think you need to follow it. Mind you, I'm like 5 years sober, right? You don't need to follow that. And I get a speeding ticket, then I get another speeding ticket, then I get another speeding ticket. Now I'm getting worried, right? It's like, how many of these things can I get? So it's one morning, and I'm driving. It's like 7 o'clock, and I'm going through a school zone, and dun-dun-dun-dun-dun, and I'm texting, and the sun's in my eyes, and all of a sudden there's lights behind me, and I think, oh, this isn't good. So I pull over, and this cop is pissed. And it's 7 o'clock in the morning, and he's ready to haul me to jail because I was doing 52 in a school zone. And he's mad. He's like, he's real mad. And mind you, when I get pulled over, I don't give these guys the lip. You know, I was wrong. Like, I legitimately was speeding. Like, what am I supposed to argue about it or something? I mean, I'm not like a pretty blonde. Like, I can't like giggle and get out of it. You know, it's like I'm a dorky looking redhead with tattoos. I mean, what do you want from me? So I say, yeah, sorry. Guy gives me the ticket, and I pull away, and it's a big ticket. It's a real big ticket. And I get out to Route 4 near Killington, and a cop drives by, and I think, whew, it'd be bad if I got pulled over twice. And I'm like, I'm shaking, you know, I'm like nervous. It's that, like, back to when I used to get pulled over type of nervous, which I don't like. I don't like. So I drive up, I go up over the hill, I pass this truck in a passing zone, I go about 5 miles an hour over the speed limit, I'm coming back over, some lights go on. I think, you gotta be kidding me. I pull over, the cop says, when was the last time you were pulled over? Just a little bit ago. Oh, like this week? No, 20 minutes ago. And he looks at me, like, are you for real? And I said, I was just passing the truck, I didn't, whatever, give me the ticket. And he didn't give me a ticket, but he said, you better slow down. And I sat in that car, and I had this conversation with God. And what the conversation with God was about was really step six. You know, I said, God, I don't really think this is a problem. And I know that is a problem. Like, I don't think my speeding is a problem. I don't think that if the speed limit says 45, like, I don't think going 60 is a problem. If it says 25, I don't think cruising through the town at 35 is a problem. And that I know is the problem. And that was my conversation, right? I wasn't, if you know what it says in the big book, like, I'm not willing. I don't admit it's objectionable. Like, I don't believe it's a problem. That was what I was starting to admit was a problem. About a week later, I'm trying to take a left-hand turn at a traffic light. It's yellow. So I'm like in the middle of the intersection, right? We've all done this a million times. I'm waiting. My blinker's on. It turns red. Finally, the traffic stops, so I scoot across. There was a state cop behind me. I knew he was back there. I wasn't trying to be shady. Guess what? He pulls me over. I lose my license for 10 days. I get my license back, and it was during that 10-day period where, like, I really started to get willing to believe it was objectionable. And I really started to surrender to what I was doing. I did pick up 2 speeding tickets after that. I didn't lose my license for that. But it was in between those other 2 speeding tickets where it got to the point where, like, I've realized I have to use my cruise control no matter what the road is. And I don't like that, but I believe that, like, my actions are absolutely objectionable. You know, and it's not until I can fully surrender to something, like the first step, where I can go to God in the 7th step like I do with my alcoholism in the 2nd step. You know, so the way I understand the 6th step is that the 6th step is just like the 1st step. And the way I understand the 7th step is the 7th step is a lot like the 2nd step. You know, where I surrender to the behavior and then I go to God in the 7th step. One of the other things in Alcoholics Anonymous that I didn't understand was this whole idea of living with guilt and shame. And I'm here to tell you that you don't have to live with guilt and shame. In December, my business took a contract doing program development and one-on-one counseling. It went from 20 hours a week up to 40 hours a week. I moved into New Hampshire from Vermont. It went up to 60 hours a week. It completely consumed me. I terminated the contract. In the process of me terminating the contract, all of a sudden this guy is like threatening me. It turned into a huge disaster. He was writing me these like nasty, nasty emails. I was responding with like, I'll consider everything you said. Thank you. The nastiest email I responded was, I have nothing to say to you, nor ever will. And that was after the one where he threatened me with a lawsuit. Some shady things were happening, and I said clinically, like, I couldn't refer people here anymore. He got wind of it and was threatening to sue me for defamation of character and this, that, and the other thing. So now I've got this, like, resentment, and I'm, like, imagining myself spray painting fluorescent pink, like, FU on his Cadillac. You know, like, I'm imagining myself egg his car. And it's, like, more than, like, that'd be funny. It's, like, consuming me. Like, I'm so upset. Like, I devoted a year of my time to this business. And like this guy is like, you know, dragging me through the dirt, and I have no ability to fight. My lawyer laughed at his emails, but like I don't have money to go to court. Like I can't fight that. So it's like my hands are tied. All I can do is sit on them and let this guy drag me through the dirt. And it gets to a point where about 2 weeks ago, I mean, it got to the point where I had to tell certain mutual friends that I couldn't, guys that I used to sponsor, actually, that I couldn't talk to them anymore and that they needed to stop calling me because, like, his threats just got so out of control. I couldn't, if I saw somebody that was even associated with that business, I had to leave. Like, it got really out of control. And I woke up one morning, I had this dream at 4 in the morning that we were, like, I saw him somewhere and we shook hands. And then we were out marketing together and doing lines of cocaine like everything was normal. But when I woke up from the dream, the important thing was that there was like a sense of like cleanness in my heart. Like a sense of like the resentment was gone. So at four in the morning, I wrote this guy an email, and I wrote him an email because he asked me to stay out of the town, to stay away from the business, and to never talk to him again in one of his emails. So I couldn't like go, hey, let's talk about this. So I write him this email basically, and I didn't make amends for what I did because what I did wasn't wrong. I acknowledged how it could have harmed him. And I acknowledged how he could have been upset, and I acknowledged basically that we had good times and bad times and blah, 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 blah. And I asked him those three questions that I was taught to ask people in amends. And if you don't know what they are, ask your sponsor. But I asked him, you know, what can I do ultimately to clean this up? And he responds with, let's get lunch. Ugh, the worst thing to respond with. Because I've watched him do this to other people, and he's not made amends to these people or let them make amends to him. He's treated them horribly. So now I'm like afraid. And luckily I said, I responded with, unfortunately I can't because I'm leaving the state, which was a true story. And I call my sponsor and I say, Joe, he said, so this is what happened. And he says, so what's the problem? I said, well, I feel guilty because I didn't even put in there that like maybe we could talk on the phone. He's like, well, Ian, he did ask, you did say, what can you do to make this right? And he did say, well, why don't you get lunch? And realistically, you can't get lunch, but maybe there's something else you could do. I got to go. Click. So now I'm like sitting with that, right? Like, oh, man, like, did I not do everything I could? So I did eventually respond back that afternoon. I responded back with, I didn't realize, you know, maybe we could talk on the phone. And he responded back with, you know, it is what it is. Like, there's really nothing to talk about. And I don't know if any of you have made amends to someone who's actively trying to sue you for defamation of character, especially when, like, you know in your heart that you didn't do anything wrong. But that may have been, like, one of the biggest hurdles in terms of, like, amends and step work I've done. And what it came down to is, like, I don't want to leave the country with drama. Like, I don't want to leave with nonsense. You know, as far as I'm concerned, like, what's the big deal? Like, really, do we have to act like children? You know, in this 12 step, what happens is I move through these steps over and over as they work and rework the 12 steps. I get put in this place, like the book talks about, of neutrality, safe and protected. You know, a place where I'm not cocky, nor am I afraid. A place where I know that I'm going to this, like, magical mystery kingdom, knowing that I'm not going to, like, need a meeting. And if I do need one, that there might not be one to go to, which is the problem. You know, so I've gotten involved, or ideally I will be getting involved with the Young People's Committee via Skype as their Traditions Concepts Chair. I figured no one's going to run to be the Traditions Concepts Chair. I think I might be a shoo-in for that one. Hopefully this group will Skype us in. But it's like I want to be a part of Alcoholics Anonymous today. Where for a long time, like, I was on the fence because I was, you know, at that point I was, like, 25 years old and in early sobriety. I just didn't know. You know, I didn't know if, like, you guys really had anything. It was before I really started to do the work, and I didn't really know that there was more going on here than a bunch of people complaining about their day. And what I found is that there's this group of people in this fellowship and some like really, really good men in my life, and women for that matter, who they don't just complain about their days. We absolutely do all the time together and on the phone. But ultimately, we're talking about what can we do about it. You know, how can we move forward? How can we get on with our lives? You know, and by doing that and revisiting meditation over and over, God is continuously moved me in directions. You know, I keep asking God to show me what He wants me to do and to show me where to do it. Next thing I know, I'm like getting this plane ticket to the Dominican Republic. And basically what I'm doing is I'm outsourcing myself. You know, everything we do in my business is via phone and Skype, so no one really needs to know where I am. I tried to get business loans. The banks aren't loaning money. No one seems to want to give me a $20,000 grant. So I'm outsourcing myself. Just happens to be one of the top 10 kite surfing spots in the world. You know, and that's like my favorite thing to do. You know, it's like, what a dream. Like, what an opportunity to be able to go and live, like, on this island and to be able to do what I love in many, many respects. You know, I remember 4 or 5 years ago when I got my dream job in AA, and I remember 2 years into that job, I was like, oh, this is boring. I wonder what's next. You know, my experience is that can be available for you. My experience is that you really can do anything you want in Alcoholics Anonymous, and you can go anywhere you want to go. And that the whole world is open to you. All of your wildest dreams can come true in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and that's the message that I want to convey tonight. God bless you. Thanks for letting me be here.